May 21st, 1983, Yukon, Canada. The remains of a male homicide victim are discovered in a shallow grave in a remote area, and since he cannot be identified, he becomes known as the Dawson City John Doe. 38 years later, DNA testing identifies the victim as 46-year-old Theodore Kampf, who had left his home in New Jersey in 1981 to make a cross-country road trip to Canada before he disappeared. It turns out that an unknown individual cashed Theodore's traveler's checks and stole his pickup truck before abandoning it in Montana, but the actual circumstances of how Theodore was killed are unclear. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and on this episode, we're going to be covering two cold cases from our podcast's home country of Canada, the 1981 death of Theodore Kampf and the 1989 death of Patrick Rosner. That voice you just heard narrating this intro was Natalie Galloway, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Natalie. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for nearly 5 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, The Trail Went Cold recently reached a milestone where we covered at least one cold case from all 50 American states, so one of our next goals will be to cover at least one case from every Canadian province and territory, as at the time of this recording, we've only done about half of them. So on this episode, we're going to move closer to that goal by covering one mystery from the Yukon Territory and another from Manitoba. There are a number of similarities between the deaths of Theodore Kampf and Patrick Rosner, as both of them vanished without a trace and remained missing persons for decades before they were linked to the discovery of an unidentified John Doe. And one of the reasons it took so long for both these men to be identified was because the remains were found a great distance away from the locations where they disappeared from. In fact, Theodore Kampf, who went by the nickname Teddy, was an American citizen from New Jersey who left on a cross-country road trip to Canada before he lost contact with his family and somehow wound up dead in the Yukon. What makes this story even more unusual is that Teddy's abandoned pickup truck would be found in Montana, and another individual had forged Teddy's signature in order to cash his traveler's checks in a number of different banks. In the Patrick Rosner case, he vanished after finishing his shift at his job in Winnipeg, before his remains were eventually found over 220 kilometers away in a remote area he had no connection to. It seems pretty clear that both these men were victims of a homicide, but the circumstances of how they were killed and the identities of the perpetrators are still a big mystery. So I'll start off by covering Teddy's death before I move on to Patrick's story, and then I'll provide my theories and analysis for both these cases. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or a review on any of these sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the death of Theodore Kampf. Our story begins in the Yukon Territory in 1983. On May the 21st, a family was having a picnic in a remote wooded area alongside the Dempster Highway, located approximately 40 kilometers northeast of Dawson City. When they went to collect some firewood, they noticed some hairy legs sticking out from under some brush. Upon closer inspection, it turned out that the legs belonged to the lower torso of a man who had been buried in a shallow grave before his remains were partially dug up by animals. The victim was a white male with wavy brown hair who was estimated to be between 22 and 40 years old, weighed approximately 165 pounds, and was 5 feet 9 inches tall. He had visible gold teeth and a gold subcrown, which meant he had likely gone through some extensive dental bridge work at some point. The man was clad in dark blue denim jeans, which had been crudely hemmed with orange thread, white cotton underwear, white cotton socks with red and blue bands, and a size 36 belt with a metal buckle labeled 5691 and genuine leather. A camper stove was also found at the scene, and since his jeans were originally manufactured in the United States, it was speculated that the victim might have been an American citizen. The Yukon Royal Canadian Mounted Police, aka the RCMP, would launch an investigation, and while they have never disclosed the victim's exact cause of death, the pathologist who examined the remains concluded that he was likely the victim of a homicide. Since this discovery took place before DNA became a major part of criminal investigations, the best option for identifying this decedent was dental records, but this was complicated by the fact that Canada did not use the same dental charting as the United States. In the end, the victim could not be identified, and even though he was technically found 40 kilometers outside Dawson City, he became known as the Dawson City John Doe. There would be no major developments in the investigation for nearly 40 years, but in 2019, the Yukon RCMP formed an historical case unit, which would explore a number of unsolved crimes from the area, and one of their top priorities was determining the Dawson City John Doe's identity. Even though a DNA profile had been obtained from his remains, it failed to turn up a match in any of the national or international databases, and there were some jurisdictional issues, since Canada and the United States did not have an official agreement to share DNA. However, in the fall of 2020, the Texas-based organization Othram Incorporated was contracted to offer their services in this case. In case you're not familiar with them, Othram specializes in working with law enforcement to utilize forensic genealogy to solve cold cases. Over the past few years, they have used DNA sequencing to identify the perpetrators in a number of unsolved murders, many of which were decades old, but their biggest speciality is unidentified decedents, as Othram has played a role in helping no less than 40 John and Jane Does get their names back. While traditional forensics can identify approximately 20 genetic markers in DNA samples, Othram utilizes technology such as forensic-grade genome sequencing that allows them to identify hundreds or thousands of markers and can often link these victims to distant relatives. This technology allows Othram to provide an analysis of contaminated and degraded DNA samples, and even though the Dawson City John Doe skeletal remains were degraded, they still managed to create a genealogical profile from them. After a painstaking process, Othram was able to identify distant relatives of the Dawson City John Doe, and they were able to circle back and determine his identity. On September the 13th, 2021, the Yukon RCMP's Historical Case Unit announced that thanks to Othram's advanced forensic analysis, DNA testing had positively identified the Dawson City John Doe as 46-year-old Theodore Frederick Camp Jr., who went by the name Teddy. Teddy was an American citizen who originally hailed from Oakland, New Jersey, a borough located in Camden County, over 6,400 kilometers from the spot in the Yukon where his body was found. Teddy had been reported missing 40 years earlier, and during the course of the investigation, a cold case detective from the Oakland Police Department had obtained DNA samples from surviving cousins on both the paternal and maternal sides of Teddy's family, and entered them into a national database maintained by the University of North Texas. In February of 2021, a match was made between the DNA and Teddy's genealogical profile, though it took several months before the investigators could confirm all the details and make an official announcement. Teddy was the only child of his parents, Mary and Theodore Camp Sr., and at the time of his disappearance, he had lived with them in Oakland for over 20 years. He was a single bachelor and an ex-serviceman, who made his living as a printed circuit board designer and had been employed by a number of electronics firms, including the Bell Telephone Company. In 1981, Teddy was between jobs, so on July the 6th of that year, he decided to leave Oakland on a vacation to Western Canada. He would drive cross-country in a recently purchased brown 1980 Chevrolet pickup truck with a hard-shell camper cap, and he converted $5,000 of his own money into traveler's checks. The story goes that Teddy was planning to visit a friend of his, but it's not entirely clear where this friend lived. In May of 1982, the Courier Post newspaper published an article about Teddy's disappearance, which stated that the friend lived in Dawson, British Columbia. There is a town in British Columbia called Dawson Creek, and you would have to drive through the province to make it to the Yukon, but I have a feeling that the article's writer might have gotten a bit confused about Canadian geography and meant to print that the friend lived in Dawson City, Yukon, which is about 40 kilometers away from where Teddy's body was found. Regardless, 5 days after he originally left, Teddy's parents received a letter which he had mailed to them from the road, in which he mentioned that he was getting a lot of use out of a camping stove he had packed and had recently hemmed his pants. And as you recall, Teddy was wearing hemmed jeans when his body was found, and a camping stove was at the scene. On July the 12th, Teddy called his parents from a payphone in Mount Vernon, Washington, to inform them that he was planning to cross the border into British Columbia. But after the call ended, Teddy's family never heard from him again, and this would be the last time he was confirmed to be alive. Even though Mary and Theodore did not receive any more letters from their son, they were not overly concerned, since a postal strike was taking place in Canada that summer, so they expected there to be delays with delivering the mail. However, on August the 17th, the Camps received a surprising letter from a woman named Christine Christensen. She wrote that she had gotten into a minor fender bender with Teddy's pickup truck in Boise, Idaho on July the 27th, and needed the proper insurance information to file a claim. Since Christensen provided her own contact information, Teddy's parents gave her a call, and she recounted the incident, claiming that she got their address when Teddy showed her his driver's license. However, she described the driver of the pickup truck as a tall, thin man in his 20s, which did not match Teddy's description since he was 46 years old. It was now apparent that someone else had stolen Teddy's identity and was driving his truck, so the Camps became very concerned. They contacted both the FBI and the RCMP, but neither agency would take the case since no federal crime had been established and there was no missing persons report on file for Teddy. After nearly 2 months of getting nowhere, the Camps finally contacted the Oakland Police Department, and even though Teddy's disappearance had taken place outside their jurisdiction, they found the situation to be concerning enough to launch an official missing persons investigation. It would turn out that on July the 13th, the day after his final phone call with his parents, Teddy had cashed one of his traveler's checks at a bank in Richmond, British Columbia. But over the course of the next 3 weeks, 23 additional traveler's checks would be cashed by Teddy at various American banks in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. When these checks were examined, it became obvious that the signatures on them did not match Teddy's handwriting and had been forged by another individual. Unfortunately, none of the bank tellers who cashed these checks had any recollection of the transactions and cannot provide any details of the person who provided their signature. Even though the bank in Richmond where Teddy's check was cashed on July the 13th had a security camera, it just happened to be broken on that particular day, so it could not be conclusively established if Teddy himself performed the transaction. It sounds like the friend Teddy was planning to visit in Canada was located and interviewed by the RCMP, but it's unclear if they provided any useful information, and I'm not even sure if they confirmed having seen Teddy or not. Well, on October the 29th, 3.5 months after Teddy was last heard from, a pair of hunters would discover his abandoned pickup truck in Granite County, Montana, near the town of Phillipsburg. The truck was in a ravine, located on a logging trail just off Flint Creek Pass, and while the keys were still in the ignition, there was no trace of Teddy or anyone else at the scene. Unfortunately, even though the Oakland PD had already entered Teddy's pickup truck into the computerized national database of stolen vehicles, they did not learn of its discovery for another 3 months. When the Granite County Sheriff's Office recovered the truck, they did not realize it was connected to a missing persons case. As a result, the truck was not processed like a potential crime scene and was handled by so many people that any potential forensic evidence it contained was rendered useless. Since Granite County was known for being a mining and prospecting community, investigators have theorized that Teddy's killer may have originally been from the area and worked in that field. Since gold prices were high in the early 1980s, and a number of prospectors traveled to Dawson City during this time period to dig for gold, the perpetrator in this case might have decided to do the same thing, which is how they crossed paths with Teddy. After murdering Teddy and stealing his truck and traveler's checks, the killer then used the truck to drive back to Montana. The RCMP hopes that someone out there might remember something about an individual from Granite County who traveled to the Yukon in 1981, and they've also openly expressed the possibility that multiple people may have been involved in Teddy's death. Sadly, even though Teddy was finally identified, his parents did not live long enough to learn what happened to him, as Theodore Camp Sr. passed away in 1995 at the age of 87, while Mary Camp died in 2002 at age 93. I know that the authorities were hoping to bring Teddy's remains back home to the United States and bury him with full military honors because of his past service record, but I'm not sure if this has taken place yet. So after four decades, there are still no conclusive answers about who actually killed Theodore Kampf. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in Winnipeg, Manitoba in 1989, and our victim is 20-year-old Patrick Rosner, who lives with his parents, Lawrence and Esther Rosner. Patrick has a job as a sheet metal worker with Bristol Aerospace Limited, and after his shift there ended on Friday, June the 23rd, he left at 3:45 p.m. in his 1972 Plymouth Valiant. Patrick apparently went to a bank to cash his most recent paycheck, but after that, he vanished without a trace, and even though Patrick had made plans to go out on a date with his girlfriend that night, he never showed up. Patrick also did not return home, even though he had made a number of plans for the weekend, and since he was very close to his parents, it was very out of character for him to disappear without contacting anyone. The following day, Patrick's abandoned Plymouth Valiant was found only 2 blocks away from his workplace. Even though there were no noticeable signs of struggle or violence with the vehicle, Patrick was nowhere to be found, so his family officially reported him missing to the Winnipeg Police Service. Patrick failed to show up for his next scheduled shift on Monday morning, and his disappearance left everyone completely perplexed, since Patrick was known for being a very nice, responsible guy who did not cause any trouble and had no known enemies. Some of the initial reporting stated that at around 7 p.m. on the evening he went missing, a waitress recalled seeing Patrick at a coffee shop in the nearby rural municipality of Headingley. He was supposedly in the company of another man wearing a black leather jacket who had dark hair and tan skin, but it does not sound like this sighting was officially confirmed. Other than that, investigators had virtually no evidence to work with, as there was no activity on Patrick's bank account or credit cards, and concern only increased when he did not resurface for his sister's wedding in October of that year. The following month, the authorities received a tip from a woman who lived in Gimli, Manitoba, who had just seen Patrick's photo in the newspaper. She claimed that she had recently been in South Carolina, where she met a man who resembled Patrick Rosner, and he introduced himself with a name that sounded pretty similar to that one. The man was apparently affiliated with Conklin Shows, the largest traveling amusement corporation in North America, and it turned out that Conklin had been holding a carnival in Winnipeg on the same weekend Patrick went missing. So yes, the investigation briefly explored the possibility that Patrick literally ran away to join the circus, but this lead went nowhere, and it seems likely that the man was not him. In December of 1992, Patrick's story would be featured on an episode of Missing Treasures, a Canadian TV show about unsolved missing persons cases hosted by actor Al Waxman. Patrick's parents had him declared legally dead in 1997, and the investigation into his disappearance reached a standstill until an unlikely connection was made to another unsolved cold case from Manitoba. By 2011, the Manitoba RCMP had started an historical case unit, much like the one used by the Yukon RCMP in the previous case. Their priority was to explore cold cases from the province which had gone unsolved for a great period of time, including one involving a Jane Doe who had remained unidentified for over 2 decades. On August the 13th, 1990, a farmer discovered a human skull in his hayfield near the unincorporated community of Faulkner. When the police were notified about the discovery, a further search of the field turned up additional skeletal remains, including a hand and a foot. Based on the forensic technology they had available at the time, investigators initially believed that the remains belonged to a woman between the ages of 25 and 40. While attempts were made to cross-reference the victim to other unsolved cases from Manitoba involving missing women, she could not be identified and was buried in a cemetery in the nearby community of Ashern. When the historical case unit decided to take a fresh look at the case 2 decades later, they arranged for the victim's remains to be exhumed for more advanced forensic testing, and genetic material was extracted from her teeth for the purposes of DNA testing. But to everyone's surprise, the results showed that the Jane Doe was actually a John Doe, as the DNA confirmed that the remains actually belonged to a man. Needless to say, this took the investigation in an entirely new direction, as the victim was now cross-referenced with unsolved cases from Manitoba involving missing males. After narrowing their search to four possible candidates, investigators arranged for DNA samples to be collected from the missing men's relatives and compared to the remains. In July of 2012, it was revealed that DNA testing had positively identified the John Doe as Patrick Rosner. Patrick's family was glad to finally receive answers about what happened to him, as Lawrence Rosner claimed that for 2 decades, he couldn't even go out to the grocery store without looking at every single person he encountered in case one of them happened to be his son. But of course, this revelation only brought up a lot more unanswered questions. The field where Patrick's remains were found was located over 220 kilometers northwest of Winnipeg and would have required at least a 2.5-hour drive to get there. Since Patrick's car had been left behind in Winnipeg, he obviously did not drive there himself and had no known connection to the Faulkner area. While they have classified Patrick's death as suspicious, the Manitoba RCMP have never released any information about his exact cause of death, so the actual circumstances of what happened to Patrick Rosner remain an unsolved mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So as I'm sure you're well aware, we've pretty much entered a boom period, for lack of a better term, when it comes to solving cold cases, particularly when it comes to identifying John and Jane Doe's. This is due in large part to DNA testing and forensic genealogy being utilized by such organizations as the DNA Doe Project and Othram Incorporated, who have both combined to identify over 100 decedents these past few years. It seems like we've reached an era where announcements are being made virtually every other day that a John or Jane Doe who went unidentified for years, if not decades, has finally got their name back, and that is a pretty remarkable accomplishment. Of course, thanks to Othram, the announcement of Theodore Camp's identification was made just 6 months before the release of this episode, and they have also recently identified a decedent who was featured on this podcast 3.5 years ago, the Walker County Jane Doe. This particular victim was murdered in Walker County, Texas in 1980, until forensic genealogy identified her as 14-year-old Sherry Jarvis, who originally hailed from Minnesota. Cases like this just drive home how valuable organizations like Othram really are, especially when the decedent is found hundreds or thousands of miles away from their home. I mean, in the case of Theodore Camp, you couldn't get any further away from a victim's hometown, as we're talking about complete opposite ends of the continent. In many cases where decedents were unidentified for decades, it turned out they were never officially reported missing, but that was not the case with Theodore Camp or Patrick Rosner. But because of the time period they went missing, it just took longer to put two and two together. Now, the identification of Patrick took place nearly 10 years ago, before Othram or the DNA Doe Project was around, but it was made possible by the advancement of forensics. Remember, when Patrick's skeletal remains were found during the summer of 1990, investigators initially assumed that the victim was female, so they spent years looking in the wrong direction by cross-checking the remains with missing women. In fact, when Patrick's story got national exposure on the Canadian TV show Missing Treasures, no one was aware that he had technically been found 2 years earlier. It was not until this victim was exhumed 2 decades later that DNA testing confirmed that he was male, and he was matched up with Patrick Rosner within months. While this whole situation might sound like a colossal blunder, the Manitoba RCMP's historical case unit have always stated that no blame should be placed on the original investigators because they were simply working with the best forensic technology they had available at that time, and in 1990, DNA testing was still in its infancy. All they had was a skull and a few other bones, so it would have been easy to get mixed up about the gender. While the disappearance of Theodore Camp got a bit of coverage in some New Jersey newspapers around the time he went missing, his case pretty much languished in obscurity for 4 decades, though he did get his own profile page at the Charlie Project. In fact, according to a blog post made by Megan Good, the founder of the Charlie Project, Othram confirmed to her that Teddy's profile page played a role in his identification because it listed him as an American citizen who disappeared during a road trip to Canada, helping him stand out as a potential candidate to be the Dawson City John Doe. Otherwise, would there have been much reason to believe that a missing man from New Jersey was a decedent found in the Yukon? Even though Teddy's disappearance didn't get much play in the media, Jane Jones, a former detective from the Oakland Police Department, was still actively investigating it, which is why DNA samples were collected from Teddy's distant relatives and paved the way for his identification. But you have to feel immense sympathy for Teddy's parents, as he was their only child, and they both passed away without knowing what happened to him. Of course, if there's one bittersweet aspect to all these cases where John and Jane Doe's have been identified in recent years, it's that a number of them were murder victims, and we still don't know who many of the perpetrators were, so these are technically still classified as unsolved mysteries. What further complicates the situation with Theodore Kampf and Patrick Rosner is that their exact causes of death have never been released publicly, but given the condition of the remains at the time they were found, it's unclear if the authorities are even certain of how they died either. But since Teddy was found in a shallow grave, it's pretty obvious that he was the victim of a homicide, and I'm fairly certain that Patrick was murdered as well, because it seems very unlikely that he traveled to that remote area on his own. While Teddy was found a great distance away from his home in New Jersey, he was taking a cross-country road trip to Western Canada, so the discovery of his remains in the Yukon is not that unusual. But when Patrick went missing, he had just left his workplace and was planning to meet up with his girlfriend later that night, so there's no logical reason for him to abandon his car and travel over 220 kilometers to a location he had no connection to. By all accounts, Patrick was a very responsible person who always stayed in touch with his family and friends, so this would imply that Patrick was either forcibly abducted or he accepted a ride from someone who murdered him. Even so, this seems like quite a distance to drive just to dispose of a victim's body, which makes me wonder if the killer had ties to the Faulkner area. The murders of Teddy and Patrick may have been financially motivated, as we know someone stole Teddy's pickup truck and forged his signature to cash his traveler's checks. It's been reported by some sources that Patrick went to a bank to cash his paycheck after he left work, so you have to wonder if someone was watching him and decided to rob him. What's particularly interesting is that some of the earliest articles about Patrick's disappearance state that one of his coworkers suggested that he cash his check at a different bank than usual that day. Unfortunately, I haven't seen any further elaboration on this, but it does seem like an odd coincidence that Patrick would just happen to go missing right after visiting a new bank. Even if robbery was the motive for Patrick's death, I'm guessing he would have withdrawn a couple $100s at most, and while people have been murdered for a lot less, it seems counterproductive to travel 220 kilometers to dispose of Patrick's body, unless the perpetrator just happened to be passing through that area. However, it's not entirely clear to me if Patrick's visit to the bank has been 100% verified. When Patrick was identified in 2012, an RCMP sergeant named Lynn Karpisch stated that they were focusing on Patrick's departure from work as, quote-unquote, the only firm thing they know. She added, quote, "Right now, we want to function on facts." So this would seem to imply that none of the reported sightings of Patrick after he left his job at Bristol Aerospace are confirmed. This is particularly important because one of the only leads in this case was a reported sighting from a waitress who claimed she saw Patrick at around 7 p.m. in the company of an unidentified man at a coffee shop in the rural municipality of Headingley, which is about 20 kilometers west of Winnipeg's downtown core. For all we know, the waitress could have been mistaken and saw another man who resembled Patrick, as this sort of thing happens all the time. If it was Patrick, then he theoretically could have hitched a ride with this man to the coffee shop, but again, why would he do so when he had already made plans to meet his girlfriend that night? If the sightings of Patrick at the bank and the coffee shop are not legitimate, then there really isn't much to work with at all. It's been nearly 10 years since Patrick's remains were identified, and if investigators have received any promising new leads during that time period, they never said so publicly. I always have a particular fascination with cases in which missing or murdered victims are found at faraway locations where they had no reason to be, and that certainly applies here. Though whether Patrick was alive or already dead when he made that long trip from Winnipeg to Faulkner is still a mystery. I really wish there was more I could say about Patrick's case, but that's pretty much all the information we have. At the very least, I'm glad that his family were able to get his remains back, but I'm sure they would like to receive answers someday about how he was killed. So now let's move on to breaking down Theodore Camp's death, as we have a bit more information to work with here, though there are still a number of unanswered questions. Even though Teddy was 46 years old, he was still living with his parents, and it sounds like he was between jobs at this point, which is probably why he decided to leave on this cross-country road trip. It's not entirely clear to me if this was intended solely as a vacation or if he might have had some business reasons for the trip. All we know is that he was planning to meet a friend of his in Western Canada. Like I mentioned earlier, we have zero details about this friend, and I'm not sure if Teddy actually did meet them or not. The location where the friend lived is not even clear, as one newspaper article stated it was Dawson, British Columbia, but I have a feeling they meant Dawson City, Yukon, which makes a lot more sense. The last time Teddy was confirmed to be alive was when he phoned his parents from Mount Vernon, Washington, and told them he was crossing the border, and one of his traveler's checks was cashed the following day in Richmond, which would have been on the route up north to Dawson City. If Teddy's friend was involved in his murder or the disposal of his body, that would make sense, but even though the friend was interviewed, I see no indication that they were ever considered to be a potential suspect. And besides, if the friend lived in Canada, then it doesn't make much sense for them to steal a truck and abandon it in Montana. I am really intrigued by the fact that the truck was left in Granite County, an area which is known for mining and having a history of gold prospecting. I'm sure many of you are aware that Dawson City is best known for being the site of the Klondike Gold Rush at the end of the 19th century. When gold was discovered in the Klondike region of the Yukon in 1896, over 100,000 prospectors would flock to the area over the course of the next 3 years in order to search for it. When the gold rush began, the population of Dawson City was only about 500, but it quickly became a boomtown after all these prospectors arrived, and its population ballooned to around 30,000. After the gold rush came to an end, Dawson City's population plummeted, and by the time Teddy was killed, it was home to about 700 residents. However, in the early 1980s, there was a bit of a modern-day Klondike gold rush, as the price of gold had been inflated, so a number of miners traveled to the Yukon in order to search for it. Even though Teddy's pickup truck was found in a ravine in Granite County, it's never been made clear to me if it crashed in an accident or was intentionally abandoned there. Either way, I don't think it's a coincidence that Teddy would be killed in one region known for gold mining before his truck wound up in another region known for gold mining over 3,500 kilometers away. Investigators have theorized that the killer hailed from Montana and traveled to the Yukon before they used Teddy's truck to drive back home, and I think that scenario is plausible. While you need a passport to cross the Canada-US border today, that was not required back in 1981, so this man would not have run into any issues driving Teddy's pickup back into the States. But while this has never been officially confirmed, I have to wonder if the purpose of Teddy's lengthy trip to the Yukon was somehow connected to prospecting for gold. After all, he was between jobs at this time, and he also converted $5,000 of his own money into traveler's checks, which is the equivalent of over $15,000 in today's currency. So perhaps he was planning to use that money on something related to gold, but was scammed and murdered by a con artist. The authorities have hinted at the possibility that there were multiple people involved in Teddy's death, though they never really elaborated on why they believed this. But alternatively, could Teddy have actually been murdered by a hitchhiker? Perhaps he picked up someone who was traveling from Montana to the Yukon, but this person subsequently killed him. Just over 2 years ago, I released a Trail Went Cold episode featuring two cases which each have similarities to this one, as they both involve victims who were likely killed by hitchhikers who stole their vehicles, the murders of Don Smith and Philip Fraser. The Philip Fraser case actually took place in the same region in 1988, as Philip left his home in Alaska to take a lengthy road trip to Washington State, and he actually passed through the Yukon before he picked up an unidentified hitchhiker in rural British Columbia. This person wound up killing Philip, dumping his body, and driving his car to Prince George before setting it on fire. In Don Smith's case, he was killed in Idaho during the midst of a lengthy road trip, and the likely perpetrator was a hitchhiker he had picked up. This person stole Don's truck and wound up getting into an accident in Denver, Colorado, which prompted him to flee the scene on foot, which is very reminiscent of how an unidentified man got into a fender bender with Teddy's pickup truck in Idaho. Even though this driver did not match Teddy's description, he was obviously using his driver's license, since that's how the other motorist, Christine Christensen, was able to obtain his home address and write Teddy's parents for insurance information. While she may not have realized it at the time, it's fairly clear that Christensen came face to face with Teddy's killer, though I'm not sure if she was able to provide much of a description of him, since I've never seen a composite sketch of this man get circulated. But I think he lucked out in that his fender bender was only a minor one, because if the accident had been more serious, he might have had to do the same thing as Don Smith's killer and flee the scene on foot to avoid dealing with the police. The details are a bit sketchy, but the impression I get is that the transaction where Teddy cashed a traveler's check in Richmond on July the 13th was legitimate, even though the security camera in that particular bank was broken that day. But even if Teddy did cash the check himself, it may have been useful to have photographic evidence in case he had someone else with him. Over the course of the next 3 weeks, 23 of Teddy's additional traveler's checks were cashed at various banks, though I get the impression that most, if not all of them, had an obviously forged signature. The fender bender in Idaho took place on July the 27th, 2 weeks after Teddy was last confirmed to be alive, and the geography makes sense, because if the killer stole Teddy's truck and drove south through the Yukon and British Columbia before they crossed the border into Washington, then they likely would have traveled east through Idaho to get to Montana. But I do find it odd that Teddy's traveler's checks were cashed at banks in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota, because those states are all east of Montana. So did the killer travel to all these states and then circle back before abandoning the truck in Granite County? Well, they never released the specific dates when these traveler's checks were cashed, and even though the truck was found in the ravine on October the 29th, we have no idea when it originally ended up there. So for all we know, the perpetrator could have abandoned the truck before he found alternate transportation to travel to those other states and cash the checks. It sounds like when the Granite County Sheriff's Office found the truck, they assumed it was just a routine accident and had no inkling that a crime had taken place. This might explain why they made no effort to preserve the truck as a potential crime scene, meaning that any forensic evidence it may have contained was now compromised. I have no idea if this truck is still in evidence today, but DNA testing was not yet a tool in criminal investigations back in 1981. It would be interesting if a new forensic analysis could be performed on the truck to turn up the killer's DNA, but then again, since the truck was handled by a number of different people, it might be useless as a source of evidence. So unfortunately, after all these years, there really isn't a whole lot to work with here, which is probably why the authorities are clinging to the hope that the killer hailed from the Granite County area and someone might remember details of an individual traveling from there to Yukon in 1981. We've addressed the theory of Teddy falling prey to a scam involving gold mining, but it's just as possible that he was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time and crossed paths with the wrong person who murdered him to steal his truck and traveler's checks. Much like the Don Smith and Philip Fraser cases, we have eyewitnesses here who interacted with the likely perpetrator after he committed Teddy's murder, but we just don't have enough to determine his identity. After 40 years, the killer may very well be dead, but now that Teddy has been identified, at least this has given his case new life, and investigators will do everything in their power to solve this crime. So if you happen to have any information about the death of Theodore Kampff, please call the Yukon RCMP's Historic Case Tip Line at 867-667-5500. That's 867-667-5500. And if you happen to have any information about the death of Patrick Rosner, please contact the Manitoba RCMP's Historical Case Unit at 204-984-6447. That's 204-984-6447. Or if you prefer to remain anonymous, you can call the Manitoba Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-222-8477. That's 1-800-222-8477. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Natalie Galloway for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special bonus episode about the unsolved disappearance of Mel Wiley, a police chief who vanished from Hinckley Township, Ohio in 1985. In addition, we've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unsolved 2004 murder of Sarah Fox. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Daniel M., Katrina H., Gravityhead Nero, Kimberly T., Phoebe H., Lisa A., Perry W., and Becca C. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, in just 1 month, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held at Paris and Bally's in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge. Please visit CrimeCon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, go to CrimeCon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. And provided that it is safe enough to travel there, I'm also hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you would like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COLD22. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COLD22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶